The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
From March 5th to 8th, Pope Francis will visit the majority Muslim country that is also home to about 400,000 Christians, about 1% of that country's total population. But what can we expect from this four-day trip that some are calling the papal visit of the century and the defining stop of Pope Francis's papacy? What distinguishes this trip from the Pope's previous travels around the world?
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome. It is good to be back here with you. Always so much fun to hang out with you. And boy, there's a lot going on, isn't there? From the Holy Father to COVID to what's happening in our nation's courts and, well, in your home. Thanks for allowing me in. Pope Francis has left Iraq, and he's headed back to the Vatican. And I don't know how much of the story you followed. I've been trying to give you a little bit of coverage on it every single day, just so you're in the know. He is the vicar of Christ, right? And I think where he goes, special graces follow. His visit was historic. You know, he, of course, being the first successor of Peter to have ever visited that country. And I think that was pretty amazing. It was meant to give a boost primarily, I think, to the Christians of Iraq. They've been beleaguered now for many years, especially after the Islamic State invasion of that country in 2014. That, to me, seems like it was yesterday. I mean, I look back at the dates, and I'm thinking 2014, 2017, and I don't know where time has gone. The visit also was the first, if you're not aware of this, first time a pope has visited a leader of the Shiite Muslims in the country. So Pope Francis is about unity. And that's what the message he was trying to communicate. You know, he visited with the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. He's 90 years old, this Islamic leader, 90. And they hung out for about 45 minutes. They had a 45-minute meeting that Christians in that country said this. They said it should be, quote, like all Iraqis in security and peace, and with full constitutional rights. Because there's no separation right now of religion and state, the Ayatollah also pointed out that the role that religious authorities play in protecting them and others who have suffered injustice and harm over the past years, that should come to an end. But it's very good to hear from somebody who could make a real difference in how Christians and other religious minorities live there. The Pope visited some ancient sites. We talked about the ancient site of Ur, depending how you want to pronounce it. That's the city that Genesis tells us where Abraham came from. And there he held, you know, in a religious ceremony, because three great, you know, monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all consider Abraham to be the father of the faiths. He went ahead and he returned also, which I thought was kind of cool, a prayer book that was saved from the Islamic State. It was a historic Aramaic prayer manuscript, which was restored after, you know, ISIS, the Islamic State, desecrated a church where it was once held. And it dated back, I think, somewhere between the 14th and 15th century. But the book contained liturgical prayers in Aramaic. And that's the language, of course, that Christ spoke. Really sad what happened in that country and a lot of others. You know, you see the desecration of churches, the erosion of history. What ISIL did was just tragic is the word I think I'm looking for. Just absolutely tragic. Father Christopher Clohessy, he was behind the story, sharing the importance of this trip that the Holy Father took. And, of course, it wraps up today. He said that Iraq has had a lot of troubles, but Pope Francis, you know, he really wants to help. Did he? Here's what he said.
It's not that it's been at war with some other country. It's been at war with itself. And the damage that has been done to the national psyche, the Iraqi psyche, to faith in that country, to citizenship in that country, is beyond telling. And therefore, despite the obvious threats and dangers, I suspect that on many levels this visit is going to bring a substantial amount of healing, not only to the Christians, but also to ordinary faithful Muslims who need something, some sign that Iraq is not forgotten, that it's not a backward nation, that the people who live there are as important as any other people. I think Francis is saying this loud and clear, not only to them, but to the whole world.
All right. I'm joined today by Father Benedict Keeley. He's a Catholic priest who was incarnated in the personal ordinariate of Our Lady of Walsingham. He was born in London. He, of course, became a priest. He spent most of his priestly ministry in the United States, and he joined us last Friday. I invited him back. He has been very passionate over the years, trying to focus attention on the plight of persecuted Christians around the world, and he's lived in Iraq on multiple occasions. He's visited that war-torn country. In fact, he was there in 2015. And he's working on a project now. We can talk a little bit about that with him, too. It's called it's called the Nazarene. Nazarene.org is a website. I think, I don't know what the exact name of the project is. Nazarene.org, perhaps. It's a project started in Syria and Lebanon and in Egypt. But he joins me today. I'll get clarity from him right now. Father, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me back, Drew.
Forgive me for I know your website. We talked about it. It's Nazarene with an S, N-A-S-A-R-E-A-N. We talked about that on Friday. But what is the official title of your project that you work on?
Well, that's the title of the charity. That's our
Nazarene.org?
Website, the charity name. But okay. You're probably referring to within the charity what we do by helping Christian families start businesses, mini microfinancing businesses. We call it Project Jonah because, of course, Mosul, the city that the Pope went to just yesterday, it's incredible to think of it. Mosul is Nineveh, where Jonah preached, where his tomb is. As I told you, I think on Friday, I've been there twice and have seen the tomb that ISIS blew up. But the whole idea of the Lord Jesus, of course, referred to Jonah and the 3 days in the well. That's the great symbol of the resurrection. So called Project Jonah because of that idea of bringing new life. We give mini microfinancing to Christian families to start their own small businesses so they can stay in their own country and not just survive but thrive.
Yeah, you were there in 2015. What was it like after ISIS rolled through that territory destroying churches and all sorts of history and just their presence was so dominant, particularly in 2014? What was it like to be there?
Well, they were just down the road. I've been 7 times. The first visit, yes, was in May of 2015. The place Erbil, the city where the Christians had been driven out to from the Nineveh Plain, 120,000 Christians. They'd been living initially on the streets, literally on the streets, in 120-degree heat in August. Because remember, ISIS drove them out the night of the Feast of the Transfiguration. And so a few months later, I was there. It was a very strange experience. I mean, the Christians were traumatized. They were living in basically shipping containers by that point, in empty and abandoned buildings. And the priests, even though I'm a priest, I have to say it, the priests were marvelous. They were really running everything. The church was really the only organization that was doing anything for these people, Christian charities, NGOs. But it was an experience, Drew, I can tell you, flying in. I was on the plane flying in with basically a couple of guys with beards who looked like special forces and basically no one else. So it was the priest and the special forces. And we just flew in, not like you know how normally a plane when they say, oh, we're beginning our descent, and that's usually 20 minutes. Well, there was no beginning our descent. The plane just shot down on the ground because ISIS was a few miles away. They had surface-to-air missiles, and if that had happened, would have been lucky I always go to confession right before I fly, but it could have been nasty.
Oh boy, that's a frightening ordeal, and you had to live through that several times. That's amazing. Yeah. So the Holy Father, he's made this trip, first time in history, as we point out, to visit this country for the Vicar of Christ, and I love it. The people are beleaguered, they're war-torn, they have left the country in large part. You know, we talked about the exodus from that country for Christians, and there is persecution. Did the Holy Father accomplish anything? I mean, is this a long-lasting thing? Is it a feel-good moment? How do you read it?
Well, first and foremost, I think, yes, very, very positively. I think the fact that he came is almost more important than what he said, but it's very, very powerful that he was warned not to go. Some people in the church said he shouldn't go. They said that he'd spread COVID, et cetera, et cetera. But no, I think the fact for the Christians to see the Pope in these places where they had suffered so much was was so powerful. Will it have a long-term effect? That's the really tricky question. I mean, please God, he will, it will, but unfortunately, he challenged the civil authorities to allow equal rights under the law. As you said in your introduction, yeah. Christians and all minorities don't have equal rights. They're second-class citizens. But even today, a bill was introduced in the Iraqi parliament that will basically allow Islamic law to be not just the law of the land, but will probably deny all religious minorities even more rights. So in the longer term, when we look back, we'll be able to say, I would say, Drew, that we can say this visit was a success if in the future two things happen. One, that equality under the law comes in. And secondly, if Christians stop emigrating, if they can stay, if they can have stability and economic hope for the future.
So I don't see how it's going to happen. Look, anything's possible with God, and I don't want to limit him. But, you know, if Islamic law, Sharia law, becomes a law of the land, Christians are going to remain secondhand citizens. I mean, we know what the Quran says about the infidel and how they're to be treated. I mean, I don't see how Christians can survive or thrive in an environment like that. And I know we're called to do that, but give me your take on that.
Well, one of the things I've argued for a long time, and it's something that doesn't come up very often, is we have the leverage in the West of trade and aid. And I think it's very important for the administration, the new administration, to use that leverage of trade and aid to say, unless you start granting equal rights to citizens, then we pull back aid when we pull back trade. It's an economic power that we have. If we don't, I mean, unfortunately, we know we're trading with a lot of countries that are pretty bad. But yes, you're right. I mean, if this Iraq should be, even though it's majority Muslim, it should guarantee the rights of all religious minorities. And that's what the Pope asked for, and that's what he was trying to stress with fraternity, etc. But it's got to be actually legislated. It can't. It's great to have good talk and nice feelings, but this needs to be legislated. So that's the real hope, but that's the anxiety that people have, that nothing really will. I've heard from a couple of priests saying that, well, it was great, we were really happy, but we worry that things will just go back to the way they were.
Yeah. Share with me, Father, if you could, some of the atrocities or the horrors that you saw in that country. And the reason I ask you to do that is because the Holy Father on this trip called on Christians to forgive the Islamic State for all that the state did to Christians. And you know, it's hard to forgive those who persecute you. We're called to do that, of course. Christ did it from the cross. But when somebody hurts you, you know, when you're angry, when you've lost something you love or someone you loved, that's a big task to ask. What went on? For those who don't have a historical context for what unfolded in Iraq recently through the Islamic State, maybe paint a picture of that. And then let's talk about this call that we're all challenged to embrace, the call to forgive.
Well, what went on was demonic. You in your introduction, you said the word tragic, and it was tragic, but it was also demonic. Yeah. They swept across through these ancient towns and cities where Christians have lived for 2,000 years, and monasteries are from the 4th century. One of the things that struck me that first time, but the second time, really, I was able to get out a bit more and see some of the destruction, and then in later days, is the destruction of the churches. They everywhere you saw the cross, wherever a cross, imagine in our churches, wherever you see a cross, we see a lot of crosses in our churches, they were always smashed. The Islamists hated the image of the cross. They hated all images. They smashed every statue they could. They ripped every picture, every icon. But the cross, they have a special hatred for. And so they did that. They destroyed things. They blew things up. But yes, they drove all the Christians out. They gave them the choice of convert or die. There was no real other choice. Some people say, well, they were given the choice of paying the religious tax. Well, that wasn't real. It was convert or die. And so Christians had to make that choice, and they chose to leave. That's the point. But the ones they caught and the ones they kidnapped, the women, the children, terrible, terrible things happening, murders, even of babies, of small children. Just horrible stuff.
So that brings us to that call to forgive. I mean, it's hard to do for a mother when her child was murdered or a husband whose wife was raped. Where are the people? You know, can they do that? And you know, what's your perspective on the whole? It's a heroic call from the Holy Father. You know, telling the Christians, "Hey, you must forgive."
You're right. It's the Christian teaching. I think first and foremost, we have to remember that forgiveness isn't an emotion.
Right.
It's an act of the will. I think we all find that hard in our own lives. And I know as a priest, when people say, "I can't forgive this person, Father," it's not an emotional thing. We don't have to feel right. love. It's an act of the will. And I think it takes a very long time. Yes, it's a big call. I would say many of them are not there yet, partially because, or mainly perhaps because, they haven't had any sense that the forgiveness that they would offer is going to be, there's going to be some reciprocity. And that what I mean by that is many of the buildings are still destroyed. There hasn't been a move, as it were, from the other side. Now, it's true, we don't have to wait for someone to ask for forgiveness, but it's a big call. I mean, I'll give you one example. It's one small example, but one of the priests said to me, they took my house, they destroyed my church, my 800-year-old church. In fact, they used the church as a torture chamber. He said,
wow.
It's very hard to forgive. So I think the Pope is calling all of us to the highest ideal, but it's going to take a lot of time and a sense that the other side also wants to make that sort of move as well, which is difficult.
Well, yeah, I hope the encounter with Pope Francis and the Ayatollah bears good fruit. I know the Ayatollah statement about Christians being full-fledged Iraqis, it was positive. Will it have an impact on how the state treats them, do you think? What influence will he have?
Well, that was very important. It was very important the Ayatollah was willing to see him. He hasn't been pictured for a number of years, apparently, so the fact that he allowed the cameras in, they seem to have a good dialogue. And yes, that was an important word from him. It should have an effect, but again, it seems that you're dealing, Drew, as well with for our listeners, incredibly complicated politics in that country. I mean, if we think politics is bad in the U.S., or you're dealing with a cauldron of different interests and factions and militias, and it's really not a very, let's be brutal, it's not really a functioning state,
right, exactly.
And this is part of the problem. The Christians, one of the things they always ask for, and the other religious minorities, is the rule of law. And in fact, the Pope briefly addressed that when he spoke to the civil leaders at the beginning of the visit. He said regard for the law is important. And that was a kind of code, I think, that the problem is law is not equal in that country, and this massive corruption, incredible corruption. So it's really, really hard. The Christians have to just be a witness. That's what the Pope called them to several times. And of course, we know the word witness is also martyr. They have been martyred, but they have to now be witnesses to living the faith. Can I tell you one beautiful story?
Sure.
I think the listeners would love
Please.
It.
Love it.
One of my friends, who in fact guides me when I go there, who drives me around and translates for me, his name is Johanna, John in Aramaic. Because remember, they speak Aramaic, the language of Jesus, still as conversation. I remember hearing them talking on the phone one day, on the cell phone, and I said, "What language are you talking on the cell phone?" And Johanna said, "Aramaic," as though you're kind of an idiot. Don't you realize we talk Aramaic? But anyway, Johanna, he took food with some other Christians to Mosul while the fighting was still going on, just towards the end, just before ISIS was defeated. He brought food to Mosul, to the outskirts, to feed the Muslims. And one of the Muslims said to him, "Why are you feeding us? We betrayed you. We betrayed you. We took your houses and we betrayed you." And Johanna said, "Because we're Christians."
Wow.
See, that's the beauty. That's the beauty of the Christian faith being lived. And so I think that's a sermon, a homily in action. Without
that's words. That's how the early church converted, you know, pagan Rome and the world. Really, we were there during the bubonic plague, and Christians were there during these horrible times in Iraq. Hey, Father, thank you for your ministry, for your eloquence, and for your time today. I'm grateful for all of it. If people want to get more information, could you again tell them how they can best connect with you?
Thank you, Drew. It's Nazarean.org, and it's important to spell it Nasarean.org, and you can find everything on the site. And
Sounds great. And
there's a prayer card as well people can get if they want to pray to Our Lady for the persecuted Christians.
That's fantastic. In fact, we'll put that link up on our Twitter page for everyone who follows us, Father. Father, thank you.
Thank you, Drew.
We'll talk
bless
again
you.
Soon.
Bless you.
Thank you. God bless
you.
That's Father Benedict Keeley. And I'll tell you what, the website again, Nazarean.org. Jake will put it up. I do need to take a short pause. We're going to be back with more right after this with Dr. Barbara Golder. There's been some new news. Does your blood type increase your COVID-19 risk? We'll look at that and more.
We just sang the Alleluia. Everyone is standing, and it looks like the priest and the deacon are talking about something. Hi, this is Father Rocky with our 17th Lenten lesson on the Mass. Did you ever wonder what the deacon asks the priest before he proclaims the gospel? He says, "Your blessing, Father." And then the priest says in a barely audible voice, "May the Lord be in your heart and on your lips that you may proclaim the gospel worthily and well. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen." The gospel readings for weekdays follow a 2-year cycle, and for Sundays follow a 3-year cycle. The gospels are according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The 4 gospels we use today are the same used by the early Christians. In fact, the New Testament as we know it, 27 books in all, has been the same since at least 170 AD.
One of the 3 pillars of Lent is prayer. So make this your best Lent yet by joining Father Rocky for the Family Rosary Across America every evening at 7 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Divisions on display as more states loosen their restrictions. Arizona joining Mississippi and Texas, removing capacity limits on restaurants, gyms, and theaters. And after a year in the dark, New York City movie theaters are printing tickets once again.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
There you go. That news from NBC News. A lot to talk about regarding COVID-19. And I want to fill you in on blood type, even travel. You know, you might be wanting to leave the country and, you know, there's talk of vaccine passports and a whole lot of other things. There's a new app out that you might be able to put on your phone. Put you at the top of the line. So we'll get into that in a lot more. But let me tell you what's happening here right now. The CDC, and that's the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Today they issued a new interim guideline for people who have been fully vaccinated. So did you get your vaccine? Are you fully vaccinated? If you are, then turn up the radio because this will impact you. Full vaccination. If you want to know what that means, by the way they're defining it, it means people who have received both shots, either from Pfizer or Moderna, and have waited 2 weeks, or who have received the J&J shot, the Johnson & Johnson single shot, or, you know, more than, you know, 2 or more weeks ago. So you have to have these shots, and 2 weeks have got to pass. The good news, if you can look at it that way, is that the CDC says that you can now meet together indoors with small groups without masks, or having to, respect those social distancing guidelines. So if you've been vaccinated, you've gone the 2 weeks, no masks, you can get together, you can celebrate, you can have parties, you can go to the funerals, you can do all of those types of things. They also say that if you do get exposed to someone else who has come down with the virus, they don't need to be quarantined. But the CDC did say that everyone, even those who are vaccinated, should continue with all mitigation strategies when in public. So where are we in this? Are we out of the woods? Are restrictions loosening up? More vaccines are still being given out. I saw a poll just this morning. It comes from Pew Research. It said 19% of adults say that they have received at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine. Another 50% said they definitely or probably plan to get it. And taken together, that brings you up to about 69%, right? 69% of the public intends to get vaccinated or already has. So up significantly from about 60% who said that they plan to get vaccinated in November. So attitudes are changing. More people are being vaccinated. And that news, that comes after Texas and Mississippi lifted their mask mandates. And we talked about this last week. They're gone. You know, you go to Mississippi, Texas, they've completely lifted their mask mandate. South Carolina has lifted its mask mandate for restaurants and government buildings. And that was actually the only mask mandate that was in place in the Palmetto State. So masks are no longer required there at all. So NBC will give you another look at the division that's now growing between people who want to continue your restrictions versus people who don't. And I don't know how you feel about it. You might say, hey, let's keep these restrictions in place till our herd immunity is up. Other people might say, look, we don't need to be wearing masks. I've had even physicians on say that. So which side of camp do you find yourself on? Maybe you're a little bit in the middle. Listen to this.
Perfect blue skies and aqua-colored water are pulling waves of people to Miami Beach over spring break.
Honestly, everyone's like almost piled up on top of each other here.
Causing concern, months of progress on COVID could be undone, even as some visitors distinguish between risky behavior and relaxation.
You're not really breathing someone else's air. If you go to a restaurant, let's be honest, I mean, you're on top of everybody.
Up the coast, Bike Week at Daytona Beach is expected to drive around 400,000 people to the city. As mutant strains like the UK variant, so plentiful in Florida, could find new homes.
Do people need to understand they can come here and then go home and essentially export these variants or virus to their own communities?
You have to be concerned about, you know, furthering the spread of these variants by people coming to Florida and not taking those precautions.
So some medical experts are not thrilled with the idea. In fact, they're expecting that lifting these mandates will bring a spike in cases. But right now, the number of new cases, they're on the decline. And, you know, we've got new variants coming up, but the number of cases are still on the decline. The dioceses, or most dioceses in Texas, I understand, are continuing to have the mass protocol and social distancing. So I guess it's up to, you know, your local church as well. News is coming out also that the U.S. government is claiming Russia is engaged in a disinformation campaign against Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. So there might be some stuff on the web that you might see. It's an attempt to boost their vaccine in their own countries. Several other countries, China as well, has they've developed vaccinations. Of course, J&J, AstraZeneca, we've got some others in the mix here. So I've invited to join us today Dr. Barbara Golder. She's a physician, an attorney, a bioethicist. She's been a great contributor to this program over the years. In fact, she's the editor-in-chief of the Bioethics Journal. And I hope I'm not quite sure how to say that. Is it? I'll have to ask her when we come on. I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I zoned out. But you can find her at ladydoclawyer.com. Doctor, forgive me. What's the name of the journal that you are the editor-in-chief of again?
The Lineker Quarterly.
Lineker. I could not remember that to save my life. Thank you for being here. First of all, a lot going on here with COVID, as you hear. Your idea, your thoughts as we get into this on the mask mandate. A lot of states are lifting it. As I said, there are places that are still keeping it intact. But is that a good sign? And what are your thoughts on where we are?
My thoughts on that are simply this. We now have created an experiment that will tell us what we should have done. We'll just have to wait and see. I would hope that the combination of the number of people who've been infected and have some native immunity and the beginnings of a good vaccination program might get us through this, but it might not. And there's concern that we may be lifting those kinds of restrictions a little too soon. We'll just have to wait and see. I hope that's not the case.
Well, I hope it's not the case, too. We'll see what happens. I know you had a debate with Dr. Littell months ago about masks. So lifting masks, letting people go to restaurants. I would hate to see a you know, a setback here. It'd be terrible for the economy and for individuals at large. And there's a bunch of variants that are supposedly out. We talked about South Africa, the one from the UK, California version. What are we seeing in terms of variants? Are they are they weaker? Are they more contagious? Are they something we should be concerned about? I mean, where are we right now in terms of our fight against COVID and your thoughts on the rise of these variants? I'm assuming the virus is trying to stay alive. That's why it's mutating. But give me your take on how threatening they can be.
Well, that's exactly what viruses do. They mutate, and the respiratory viruses are famous for this. You see this every year in the flu virus. You know, there's one or another strain, and that's really what we're talking about, strain of flu virus, a strain of coronavirus that emerges. So, yeah, I suppose it's trying to stay alive. But that's what viruses do. And so far, it looks like these viruses that are the new strains are more contagious, but not particularly more serious, not more deadly, not associated with right. more complications. But that might not always be the case. And the concern that you have to have is that these viruses won't be covered in the same effective way by the vaccines. And by the way, one of the reasons that it's important for everybody to get vaccinated who can, in fact, be vaccinated is that it decreases the reservoir of people in whom these new strains can emerge. I mean, everybody who's not vaccinated is liable to be infected and basically be the means by which one of these mutant strains, which may well in future be much worse, comes out.
Yeah, there's a new statement, speaking of vaccines, from the pro-life Catholic scholars about the acceptability of the vaccines. Have you read that? Are you familiar with what they wrote?
I have. I think it's a very straightforward and clear document from people who are on the front lines of bioethics and medicine. And I think that's important to understand. These are people who understand the science of it as well as the ethics of it. And it comes on the heels of the document from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith that said basically if there is a vaccine out there, a Catholic can take it with confidence that he's not offending his that he right. can take it with a clear conscience, that these are morally acceptable, although they may not be ideal, and certainly they're not. So I think that's an important piece of this. People have got very confused about what's available and how should I think about this. Basically, the congregation says, if there's not a choice, and this is important, in every place, there's not a choice. You go in to get your vaccine, and they have what they have, and you take it or you leave it. So there is choice isn't involved here in terms of actually getting people vaccinated. All of these vaccines are acceptable to the Catholic, particularly because we have an obligation to protect people around us. We have an obligation to the common good. And that's the other piece of this that sometimes gets lost in the discussion. We have an obligation to our fellow human beings to do what we can to help stem this pandemic.
So to that point, and I'll open the phone. So if anyone wants to join the conversation, feel free to dial in. If you have a question, a comment, the number here is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I'm speaking today with Dr. Barbara Golder. To the point of the ethics of the vaccines, and this has been hotly debated, you know, I don't know how long, ever since Pfizer and came out with theirs, and Moderna came out with theirs. You had the AstraZeneca, now you got J&J. And I've had ethicists on the air who said exactly what you just said. Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you believe, I understand, might be better for some situations. And again, you know, if we have choices, is there a vaccine that you would recommend? Is there one with better efficacy? Is there one with better morality? How does all that shake out for you?
For me, let me preface all of this by saying everybody has to make his own informed conscience decision about these things. But it tends to be a very personal thing that there's really a broad scope of what Catholics can believe about that, and I want to make that clear. Now, from the efficacy of the vaccine, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine seems to be a little more efficacious, meaning give you better protection against getting infected. But the Johnson & Johnson vaccine seems to be better at keeping you from getting really serious disease if you are infected. So those are sort of trade-offs. The other piece to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is that unlike the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, they have to be held under very particular circumstances, very low temperature, makes them very, very difficult to transport and administer. Johnson & Johnson vaccine doesn't have that. So it's one shot, it's easier to store and distribute, and it gives a reasonable protection. That makes it a really good vaccine for places like rural areas or nursing homes or populations who are coming back for a second vaccine is going to be harder. It's going to be great for the whole continent of Africa, where distributing this in rural areas would be very difficult for something as touchy as the Pfizer Moderna vaccine. So they both have their advantages and disadvantages, and it depends on who you are and where you are.
Yeah, no, I could not agree with that more, and I know there's other vaccines that may be coming forth too. Bottom line on this particular issue, and we'll grab a couple calls for you. You believe that taking the vaccine carries a moral obligation of its own. And the Holy Father, of course, has gotten his. Many people are encouraging others to get this, that we have a responsibility and duty to the common good, to be our brother's keeper. Is that where you're coming from on this, when you say it carries a moral obligation to get vaccinated, to reduce the risk of harm to others?
That's exactly where I'm coming from. And again, let me emphasize it. Everybody has to make that balance personally. But to discuss only how the vaccine is made and not discuss what taking the vaccine will do for the people around you is to miss half of the equation, so to speak.
Right. All right. Well, that's good to know. All right. We'll take a few calls for you. Our number, 888-914-9149. In fact, let me take a quick break here because I know we're going to have to take one in a second. So rather than cut off the callers, we'll take a short pause. If you want to get in, my guest, Dr. Barbara Golder, we're taking a look at COVID-19 and some of the latest, including the Johnson & Johnson vaccination and blood type. I haven't gotten to that story yet. I want to talk to you about that, doctor. And will you need a vaccine passport to travel? Well, there's an app out that may remedy that whole situation. We'll share a little bit of what we just discovered about that right after this.
Tell one friend about the Chaplet of Divine Mercy and invite them into the loving arms of Jesus. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy begins soon on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
CDC recommends that fully vaccinated people can visit with other fully vaccinated people in small gatherings indoors without wearing masks or physical distancing. Remember, here we are talking about private settings where everyone is vaccinated.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
So that's good news, right? You can get together. Again, they say if you've had the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine or the Johnson & Johnson 2 weeks have gone by, then you can get together without masks, without having to do the social distancing requirement that's often to ask. But I think a lot of people probably did that anyway. How many small gatherings have you been part of where everyone had their masks off? Not that it's right. I'm not saying that it is, but that's good to see. We're making progress. Looks like there's light at the end of the tunnel. And that was Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She's the CDC director. Before I take a call, I'll bring up to speed on one final issue that I personally find compelling. I'm going to be going in June to pray in Guadalupe, Mexico. I'm going to be on a pilgrimage. So I'm going to be traveling. Dr. Bob Tabali, who's an epidemiologist who's on this program, he's going to be on that trip with me and a bunch of others. And it's good to get back with that family. I used to take trips all the time, and it's good to be able to do that. But, you know, we need to have our PCR test before we go, and a PCR test when you come back. Would it be helpful to have an app that would, you know, tell the, you know, immigration whether you've been vaccinated or not? Will we see a passport, some sort of COVID passport in the future? NBC, not NBC, ABC, took a look at this issue, and they did a report on a COVID app, something that you might want to have for your phone. Listen to what they're reporting.
What if you're fully vaccinated? Well, Clear announced yesterday that you could upload your vaccination information onto their app. Now, it's free, They say it's safe. And in the future, if airports, businesses, sports arenas require proof of a vaccination, you basically upload your vaccination information onto their app. It flashes green. It means you're good to go. It's a lot easier than holding up your medical paperwork, for example. Now, Clear has been doing something similar for a few months now with negative COVID tests. If you upload your negative COVID test onto their app, same thing happens. Flashes green just like this. It means you're good to go. If you're boarding a flight, for example, and you show a negative COVID test, it might allow you to skip quarantine in certain places like Hawaii, for example.
Which places are going to require people to be fully vaccinated before they can enter?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the big question. You have states right now that are fully opening up 100% their businesses without requiring a mask mandate, without requiring proof of vaccination. And we're still far from everyone having access to a vaccination. So it's unclear which businesses will require that proof of vaccination. And also on top of all of this, there are people who have privacy concerns about uploading their information into an app. So still just a lot of questions when it comes to apps like this.
All right. So it's food for thought. I'm just putting it on your radar. My guest today, Dr. Barbara Golder. Doctor, let's go to the phones. We'll grab a couple calls. And I do want to talk blood type with you. We'll go to Cindy first, though. She's listening to us in Kingston, New York. Hi, Cindy. Good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just have it's kind of a personal question, I guess. My husband and I were 62, healthy. We both had COVID, got through it in December. Now, do we have to get vaccinated because we did get the COVID?
That's a question you should ask your physician, because I don't know what else is going on in your medical life. But let me answer it in a different. Let me answer the concept in a different way, and that's this: people who have had COVID, if they get the vaccine, basically get a booster, so that there's some thinking that it might actually increase or improve your immunity. And generally speaking, there's not a reason not to simply because you've had COVID, although your other medical conditions may have something to do with the timing of when you take the vaccine. So discuss it with your physician and see what he has to say.
Okay, because the confusing part is we were originally told by the Department of Health in New York that we should wait 90 days before even thinking about getting a shot. But then recently I've read things that said as long as you're 14 days out from having had COVID, it's fine. So it's even that's confusing. Like, so you should just refer
to our
physicians.
It is confusing. Yeah, I think I can explain sort of how that happens. One of the things that happens after you have a viral infection of almost any kind is that your immune system gets a little depressed. The question is, how long does that stay? So the recommendation to wait 2 or 3 months is a conservative one to be sure that you've gotten out of that. The recommendation to wait 14 days is a less conservative one. And basically, you have physicians on two ends of the spectrum there. But the idea is wait long enough after the infection that your immune system can, in fact, respond. Yeah. And it is confusing. I totally get that.
Yeah. Hey, thank you very much for your call, Cindy. Doctor, a lot of people want to talk to you, but her question about whether or not you need to get vaccinated, you know, if you've had it, some people are saying, you know, why do we need vaccinations for, you know, a 99% recovery rate? Your thoughts on those who make that argument, who say, hey, you know, I'm not talking about the ethics or anything. I'm just talking about 99% plus seem to recover from this. You know, I know it's harmful for certain demographics, but for those who argue the case that, you know, they don't want to get a vaccine because they'd rather get it and recover personally.
And that's fine for them, but they may be the vector that carries it to someone who dies.
Exactly.
And that's that other half of the equation. Mm-hmm. Plus, don't forget, if you talk about infecting the entire population, even with that sort of recovery rate, we're talking about 5 or 6 million people who will die.
Wow. That's something else. Those are
we're already at 500,000.
Yeah, it's amazing numbers. It really is. All right, let's go back to another call. Before I do, I don't want to run out of time. I promise that we talk blood type too. I want to get to this issue. And there's a lot of people who don't know their blood type, so this may not work. But, you know, if you know your blood type, this might be of interest to you. There was an article I came across recently, Doctor. I know you've studied or are aware of these reports. There's been some ongoing study since this broke out that there might be certain people with certain immunity to it, or not necessarily immunity, but the certain blood type that may have some protection against this coronavirus. Of course, type A, type B, type O, you know, we got the positives, the negatives. Fill us in. What are they saying about blood type? And is that true? Does your blood type maybe give you some greater protection than others?
Well, the short answer to the last question is yes, your blood type does seem to give you some immunity, but it's not the kind of immunity that you can rely on to keep you safe from COVID in an exposure. It just means that if you take a population of individuals, this particular blood type is less likely to get infected on a whole than this other group. So it's protective, but it's not immunity in the same sense that vaccines are. So vaccine is still important. But it looks like that type A people are more susceptible to COVID, and type O are less susceptible. And that's just, someday we'll figure out why that is. But I think at this point, it's just a genetic curiosity to be aware of.
You and I were talking at the break. You also mentioned unless you have Neanderthal genes?
They studied. They've studied this too. There's a way to characterize what percentage of genes from Neanderthals are in an individual, and they're actually, you can go online and buy these packages that will do this for you. But it's a legitimate assessment. They've done this, and apparently somebody did a study, not unlike the blood type study, and discovered that for whatever reason, a higher percentage of Neanderthal DNA seems to make you less susceptible to COVID as well. So there'll be all kinds of these little genetic quirks that will show up. Well, those are just two of the most interesting ones.
That's fascinating to me because, you know, you have one spouse who gets COVID and the other doesn't. They sleep in the same room. They eat at the same table. They share the same car, you know, whatever. And yet one gets it and the other doesn't. Could it be blood type? Could it be genetics? Who knows? I'm sure we'll unlock some of these secrets in the days ahead. All right. Julie in Maryland, thank you for your patience. You are on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question. My husband and I and my daughter have all been vaccinated fully. My daughter is a high school teacher, and I was wondering if we'd be able to be around my grandchildren, who's my other daughter, who's not eligible for COVID yet, or for the vaccine yet. She's not letting us all, or letting my high school teacher daughter around because she said they'd be carriers. Is that something that we could safely get around the children with? They're seven and five, and have none in that house has been vaccinated.
This gets to be a very tricky thing to handle, and we face the same thing in our family. In that I have a daughter and son-in-law, and son and daughter-in-law. None of them have been vaccinated. My daughter has a child, is our only grandchild. We're out and about far more than they are because my husband covers practices, so our exposure is greater. My husband's vaccinated. I'm not yet vaccinated. And so there's a question of how do we manage family life with those, you know, with those kinds of things, very much like you're talking about. And it becomes not so much a matter of going down the CDC list and saying this is what should happen. This really becomes a matter, in my experience, of how families respect the decisions of the householders. And, you know, part of this is how comfortable individuals feel about managing their exposure. And some people will be more conservative. Some people will be more lenient. And you just have to work that out. It's not always easy. Now, we'll say this. It's going to be much better when everybody's able to be vaccinated because I think everybody will be able to draw a great sigh of relief. But when you're talking about trying to make decisions to keep, for whatever reason, your family safe, sometimes the lines we draw are not the lines other people would draw, and we just have to learn how to live with that in charity with each other.
Yeah. Well, Doctor, I only have a moment or two left. And thank you very much for your call. But I'm going to have to wrap it here. Before I do, though, you know, Anthony Fauci has come out against some of these states that are lifting the COVID restrictions, and he thinks that this is going to be a real problem. As you point out, this is a major experiment. Who knows what we'll see? You know, in the not too distant future, will vaccines, you know, outpace any problem that he sees? And what are your thoughts on Fauci's assessment? Are we in store for a setback?
I think we potentially are. I mean, that's been the rhythm of what happens with this virus in the past. So I'm not sure it's going to change in the future unless we've reached a certain critical level of vaccination and a number of other factors that make it different. So I'm concerned too, but I can't predict that it will.
Yeah,
One of the things I think is very, very interesting is we got this vaccine quick. We'll get the next one quicker. So I think that's cause for optimism.
This. Doctor, thank you. Thanks for your time. It's always a delight having you here. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy is straight ahead. Stay with me. We'll pray together right after this.